Welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink and food in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the program. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening into the show, friends, this week, as always. Yeah, good to be back doing a new show. We took last week off due to the Memorial Day holiday. I hope everyone had a good holiday and took some time to think about what that day is actually all about here in the United States and similar holidays in many other countries around the world, honoring those who paid the ultimate price for us. Got a good show coming up for you here today. We're talking rum. Yeah, we haven't done a show specifically, hard to imagine, right? Haven't really specifically done a show on the distillate rum ever. So to that end, I have two great guests, Jeff Beachbum Berry, friend of the show, tiki author, historian, restaurateur, just a wealth of knowledge. And we record this over at his place, Latitude 29 in the French Quarter. And then we are also joined by Ben Malon Jones. And Ben is with Spiribomb. And Spiribomb is a portfolio that operates, owns, and operates a number of noted rum distilleries, including Rum Clement, Rum JM, and Chairman's Reserve. Great stuff. And as a matter of fact, similar to the show that we did on vintage cocktail books a while back, this show was recorded at Latitude 29, as I said, and then afterwards, Ben gave a presentation and guided tasting on rum, which was really, really interesting. So we talk about some of the different styles of rum, different approaches to making it, the terroir, typical styles that we see from different countries that produce rum, and all kinds of other interesting things. We taste a few expressions of Ben's, which are quite delicious, and we tell some stories and talk about some really interesting stuff. Two great guests. As you know, Jeff's been on the show a handful of times. He's always terrific, and it was great to have Ben on as well. Rum's one of my favorite spirits. I hope it's one of yours. And that's what we're talking about. Friends, want to make a quick note here. We're going to talk about this in our parting shot, podcast-only portion of the show. But I did want to send our condolences to the friends and family of the great Leah Chase, famous New Orleans restaurateur, civil rights activist, so much more. Such an important person, really, in the history of the United States, the culinary history of the world, civil rights history. Can't be overstated just how important Leah was to so many facets of life in New Orleans and well beyond. And we'll talk a little bit about that further in our parting shot. Another note, friends, next week's show, the plan right now is we're going to be chatting with Neil Bodenheimer and possibly Caroline Rosen. We'll see if we can get everybody's schedules lined up. It's our annual Tales of the Cocktail preview because, yes, Tales is coming up in mid-July here in New Orleans, as it always does. And we want to give you a little glimpse of what to expect. So we'll keep you posted on exactly who's going to be joining us, but it looks like Neil for sure at the least. That's the plan then. And the week after that, I believe we'll probably reboot again our French Quarter Fest series. Looking forward to that over there, taping that at Louisiana Music Factory. Don't know what musicians we'll have on just yet. We're working on that right now. And last programming note here, friends, before we head over to Latitude 29 for our featured interview. Yeah, we're kind of changing things up here on the NOLA Drinks Show. What we're doing, not changing really too much, the format's pretty much the same, but it used to be that the podcast came out after the radio broadcast. Now what's going to happen is the podcast is going to be out the day that it airs on radio, if not a touch before. So you can get the podcast before or close to when you would be able to hear it on the radio. But if you're listening here on the radio, go get the podcast because the podcast has our extended podcast only content, Another Shot with NOLA Drinks. So that's going to be coming out earlier. There you go. That's my big programming note for you. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drinks Show, then back talking rum at Latitude 29. Come on back.
Boat drinks. Boys in the band ordered boat drinks. Visitors scored on the home rink. Everything seems to be wrong. Havana moon, Havana moon, me all alone with jug of rum, me stand and wait for boat to come. It's long the night, it's quiet the dock, the boat she late since 12 o'clock, me watch the tide.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks, friends, for listening into the show. As always, this week, we are at one of our very favorite spots here in the French Quarter, Latitude 29. And we're doing a show on rum. As you know, I'm pleased to be joined by my two guests, the co-proprietor of said Latitude 29, a friend of the show, Jeff Beachbaum. Barry, Jeff, how are you?
Hello, I'm doing well. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you for having us, man. It's good to see you again, as always.
As always.
Great. And we're also joined by Ben Jones from Spiribam. How you doing, Ben?
Very well. And you?
I'm doing great. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for taking some time. Welcome to New Orleans.
Fantastic. I love being here. It's one of my favorite cities in the world.
Excellent. And you're here, Ben, today because people are listening to this after the fact, obviously, but a presentation that you're putting on here at Latitude 29 on some of the rums that you represent. Why don't you tell us what some of the rums that you have in your...
Yes, sir. So this afternoon, we're going to be meeting some of the talented bartenders in New Orleans. And, you know, I think a lot of them are already pretty enthusiastic and passionate about, you know, fine spirits and particularly rums. And, you know, I like to come in and, you know, have a nice casual conversation. And, you know, I'll certainly make a little bit of a presentation and talk about, you know, some of the features and benefits and the different types of rums that we make and maybe a little bit of the history and the heritage behind them. And, you know, I like to, you know, encourage a lot of questions and a lot of conversation and dialogue. So, you know, because everyone that comes in the room, they all come from different backgrounds. And I'd like to hopefully everyone walks out of the room on an even playing field.
Great. Excellent. Looking forward to that presentation. Jeff, let me ask you this question. And what we're talking about here, friends, is, you know, if you're listening at the top of the show, is we're, when we say rum, it's a very broad category that can mean a lot of different things. But I think we haven't really ever done a focus show on this this group of spirits. And I think it's fair to almost call it a group, isn't it? I mean, as I said to you before we went on the air, when we look at one of your cocktail books, oftentimes the recipes will call for two or more different types of rum, not just a single kind. It's a big world, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean... Nobody would really ever think about putting two different bourbons in an old-fashioned or three gins in a martini. It just wouldn't make sense because the bourbon category, you know, American whiskey, you do a blind tasting of 10 different brands. Yeah, there's variations in flavor and proof and things like that, but it's all recognizable as bourbon whiskey. Mm-hmm. Same thing with London gin, same thing with tequila. Rum is a whole different animal, though, and... It's because the flavor spectrum is so vast, and the distillation methods, the blending methods, the aging methods, all these things have evolved over time in different rum-producing countries to create this spectrum that's incredibly broad. And the only thing I can really compare it to is wine. Mm-hmm. As a category, not really any other spirits category. For example, you take a black Jamaican rum, like a dark Jamaican punch rum, and a white Cuban rum, and you put them side by side, they look different as night and day. They taste different as night and day. There's almost nothing to tell you that it's the same kind of spirit, but they're both cane spirits. They're both rum. Mm-hmm. And it's like if you took a Pinot Noir and you put it next to a Chablis. I mean, there's different in night and day. They look different. They taste different. They pair differently with different foods. But they're both wines, mm-hmm. you know, so it's the same kind of situation. And rum is a very difficult category to get your head around, even for people who work in it, you know, as Ben and I do. It's such a complicated situation because all the attempts to break down the category into various profiles, the way they do, for example, with Scotch whiskey, mm-hmm. you know, Islay, you know, Speyside, all these different things. Even that doesn't really work that well. The worst thing you can do is to say white, brown, or gold rum.
Right, right.
You know, because you take a gold rum from Barbados, and it's going to be distilled from molasses in a column still, maybe a little pot still blended in there. You take a gold rum from Martinique, if it's an agricole, it's going to be distilled from fresh pressed cane juice, and it's going to taste entirely differently. Same color, mm-hmm. you know, they're both cane spirits, but they have nothing in common in terms of flavor and in terms of mixability. You took that gold Barbados rum and you mixed it with lime and sugar, you'd have either a daiquiri or a Planter's Punch or what have you. But if you did the same thing with the agricole, same color, you know, salsa rum, you're going to have an entirely different tasting drink. You're going to have a tea punch.
A tea punch, yeah.
Yeah. And that's really a good way to see how differently rum plays in cocktails. Just rum, lime, and sugar. Mm-hmm. You know, just use the exact same proportions and take a rum from a Martinique, a rum from Guyana, a rum from Puerto Rico, and just see how differently they work.
Right. Now, Ben, let me ask you this question. So at its core, then, I think we're talking about sort of sugarcane is the root of all this, right? And then it just kind of varies from there, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, sugarcane has to be the first core raw base ingredient. It can't be identified as rum if not. And certainly rum was born out of the colonization of the Caribbean region because of the sugar industry. Now, you can argue that, you know, there was some sort of distillation going from a sugarcane byproduct before that, but rum was really born in the Caribbean from the sugar industry.
Mm-hmm. So then we're taking the sugarcane, and then as Jeff mentioned, so an agricole is going to be fresh pressed
sugarcane juice. Yes,
and that's a pretty common approach in Martinique, correct?
Absolutely.
And were you going to say something?
No.
Oh, okay. But what sometimes, as Jeff said, say in Barbados and many other places, people will take form molasses from it or from the sugarcane, correct? And that results in a whole different thing.
Yeah. I mean, molasses is basically a waste product in the sugar refining process. I mean, basically, instead of taking out the trash, you're using it to make rum. And originally, molasses, as industrial waste, was used to feed cattle or donkeys or to spread as fertilizer until somebody figured out, hey, wait a minute, we can distill it and it tastes pretty good.
Right.
As opposed to taking fresh pressed cane juice, was an entirely different thing. You know, that's not a waste product. That's like the cream of the crop right there. Distilling that, you know, so two very different approaches.
Yeah. So, Ben, would you say is there a terroir consideration? Jeff was making an analogy to wine. Is there a terroir consideration?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well? I mean, let me just be clear that, you know, for sure Martinique is most famous for rum agricole, and there are other neighboring French islands like, you know, Guadeloupe, for example, producing rum agricole, and there's plenty of you know, rum from sugarcane juice that was distilled in many of these other islands, you know, more so in the countryside and less, you know, away from the major sort of town city centers where the big sugar cooperatives were. But yes, as Jeff was saying that, you know, as time evolved and whatnot, you know, these islands, you know, took their paths. And now I would say about 97% of the rum coming out of the Caribbean zone is from, you know, from molasses. And yes, we are producing rum agricole from fresh pressed sugarcane juice. And that was just the way that, you know, the direction that happened as, you know, the Martinique moved out of the sugar industry as a core economic cash crop. Mm-hmm. But to answer your question about terroir, absolutely. You know, Martinique is very mountainous topographical island. You've got volcanic soils that go back 10 to 20 million years, but as well as, you know, the most recent volcanic eruption being 1929, and then most famous in 1902, where you had the disaster of Saint-Pierre, which mm-hmm. was the former capital that was destroyed. You have fresh volcanic soil. The trade winds that are coming either from the equator from South America or across from the Sahara Desert from Africa have a tremendous influence on the tropical climate, which are, you know, attacking the island at different points. You know, we have a humid season, a wet season versus a dry season. In the different elevations, you know, that you do have a little bit more of a variance of the temperature at night versus day. And so, yes, Martinique is definitely an agricole rum, is a terroir-driven spirit. But I would even like to argue, to go further, that there is microclimactic terroir conditions
okay.
that give the sort of thumbprint to each of the brands in Martinique, you know, based upon that's those microclimactic conditions, that micro terroir that I'm talking about, leads different producers in Martinique to choose what kind of sugarcane they want to use and plant at their estate and how they're going to produce and, you know, fermentation. And it really sort of leads the way they are going to have their flavor profile.
Got it. So we since you just mentioned this, Banks, I think this is also really interesting and worth pointing out is that people are using different types of sugarcane, right? Because different types of sugarcane are going to grow differently or more effectively or produce something different in different regions, correct?
Absolutely, yes.
Yep. Okay, good. That's like the high five question.
That's the high five. But I mean, we're all trying to produce good quality rum as well as, you know, as much as we can. I mean, the island is not getting any bigger. I mean, fortunately for us, the demand is growing. We're looking of ways to carry on and continue with our quality, but to be able to offer more to the world that people are asking for. And so with that, you know, a lot of R&D goes into what sugarcane growing in this parcel of land is going to give me the most Brix level sugar concentration. And what can we harvest, either if it's on a very steep volcanic slope versus, you know, how can we harvest in a plain, you know, in a flat plain type of thing. So there's a lot of different factors. And I will tell you, we are always learning. It's an always learning, always evolving process.
Right.
Of course, we have the AOC that, you know, protect some of these things and maybe can be prohibitive or restrictive in certain ways, but it's, I think, that guarantees the standard of quality that, you know, the consumer likes to have and knows that they can rely on. But we also need to remain open-minded in the way that we can always continue to be better and to make a better product. And if there's opportunity to do so, we should do that.
Great. Since you brought this up, Ben, I think it's very fascinating because Martinique, a lot of people think, okay, it's an island in the Caribbean, right? And they don't really realize it's an actual département of France, which means it's sort of like analogous more or less to a state in the United States.
Perfect, yes.
And
I frequently say that Martinique is like Hawaii to the United States.
Yeah, there you go. And as is Guadeloupe. And right. So when you mention an AOC, people, if you're not familiar with that term, we're talking about an appellation, which people are familiar with in wine. But the rum from Guadeloupe, rum from Martinique, it's a kind of an interesting example of it's an appellated consideration like wine is, whereas much of the rest of the world of spirits, tequila, pisco, there's a few other things out there, but it's controlled, correct?
It's rigorously controlled to the parcels of land. The geographical zones in Martinique are AOC certified to the types of varietals of sugarcane that we can grow, to the growing season, when we can irrigate, and then, you know, harvest, you know, the timing of delivering the sugarcane to the distillery itself for fermentation has to be within a specific time period, and you cannot ferment for over-ferment to a very high ABV, alcohol by volume, in your sugarcane wine, to distilling through a specific column still, the Creole column still. What level of alcohol can we distill at, which is between 65 and 75% ABV? So we distill, which is quite low in against all other spirits, but that's really what we, you know, because the lower proof, the ABV coming up the still, what's left is much more non-alcoholic parts, the flavor and the aromas. So that's definitely the calling card for the rum agricole. It's like the very you know, unique and bulbous and bold flavors that we get in rum agricole from that. But flavor and aroma really comes from fermentation. Distillation is really just the vehicle to deliver it. And all of those things that I just told you, you know, that come from the AOC, that are overseas, the AOC is what really delivers that standard quality that the consumer should be looking for. And then going into aging, you know, the capacity of the barrels that we can use cannot be larger than 650 liters, which, you know, it actually kind of complies to the French barrels that are coming out of southwestern France. But, you know, because of our geographical proximity to the United States, it's always been traditional that, or you see much more bourbon barrels, American whiskey barrels, American than you see barrels, in Martinique. That are also, you know, less expensive and easier to work with. Age statements, you know, so you'll see, you know, our white rum and the Elève sous bois, the gold rum that Jeff mentioned before. And then, you know, to be an aged rum, labeled as an aged rum, it has to be minimum 3 years in oak, where we have an age statement like VO or VS, VSOP for 4 years, XO, and so on, which is also, you know, I don't know if it's, I would call it a competitive disadvantage, but it's a little unique because when we come into the U.S. market, it's littered with products that say 12-year, 23, 30, you know, what have you. And then they see our rums, and they do know VSOP probably from cognac and other French brandies, but we, you know, we have to help sort of make that comparison for them and draw that relation between them.
And educate the consumer. Yeah. Let's do this, you guys. I need to take a little break here on the show. We'll come back. Hold that thought. Ben, we're talking about rum. We're here at Latitude 29, talking with Jeff Beach, Bum Berry, and Ben Jones of Spiritbomb. Come on. We'll be right back. Everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. We're here at Latitude 29 in the French Quarter, talking about rum with Jeff Beachbum Berry and Ben Jones. Guys, thanks for being here.
That's wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah, it's great having you here. It's been fun. As I said to Jeff, you guys, that it was kind of weird. You know, I've been doing this show for about 2.5 years, and we've done some focus shows on Pisco, as I said, and Mezcal and some other things. And I'm like, you know, I love rum. And I've never done a show on rum, which seems ridiculous.
You're too busy drinking it.
I'm too busy drinking it. Thank you, Jeff. Exactly. So what we're going to do now, you guys, we have two different expressions, two different styles, I think, and two different geographic locations to compare and contrast. And I think this will be an interesting exercise for listeners to sort of give an idea of the breadth of what we're talking about with the rums. And so I think we're going to start, if I'm not mistaken, Ben, I'll let you take the lead here, but we're going to start with the rum jam, and that's an agricole, correct?
An aged
agricole.
Yes. Rum jam is on the northern part of Martinique, really the precisely the northernmost tip that you can get to, what I would say on the backside of Montpellier, the volcano. And we are growing sugarcane at the highest cultivable elevation there. All the sugarcane is coming from there from our own estate right by the distillery, and so quite literally within 45 minutes or so the sugar cane that we're cutting is already being crushed, goes into automatic spontaneous fermentation sometime the following day. That sugar cane wine, which would be about less or more 5% ABV, will be distilled one time, again following the regulations of the AOC. And then this one we're having is a Lève sous bois, or known in the U.S. as our gold rum. Just to tell you, a Lève sous bois is a small, tiny segment within the way we sort of market and package our rums, offer the rums, because it's in between rum blanc, the white rum, and the rum vieux, the aged rum. So what it means is that it's a rum that's matured in wood. That's not white, but it's not old enough to be called aged rum.
Sous bois means like under wood or
yes,
in wood,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a rum that we offer. It's 12 months in small oak barrels, 200-liter oak barrels, American oak barrels. Traditionally, you would see this type of rum actually going back in history, getting its color because they were conditioning the rum in large oak vats, and so it would pick up more of like a straw color. And some of the other producers still would do that. I mean, that could be for, you know, an extended period of time, you know, not more than 36 months, but we get really, you know, fantastic color extraction as well as flavor from the oak because we don't have any of those large oak vats. We only use the stainless steel for our conditioning. So these would be the same barrels that we would be using for our typical age rums. It's just 12 months. And, you know, I guess for your listeners who can't really see the color, go find a bottle and look on the shelf and bring one home.
We'll put it on the Facebook page.
Yeah.
And on the show.
But
notes.
You can see that aging in Martinique is quite aggressive. And so 12 months gives you this beautiful, rich sort of mahogany golden color.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, also contributes a lot of flavor to the rum. It's at 100 proof, which is a fairly traditional strength for Martinique, and it's fantastic for mixing cocktails with.
Let me ask you this question real quick, and then Jeff, after that, I'd like to get your thoughts on the rum. Working with agricole can be kind of tricky, right? I think if you're pressing the cane juice, and you got to work quickly, don't you? And that's why it kind of has to be done where you're growing very nearby the distillery
yes.
and such.
I mean, you basically are exposed to the elements, so the idea to really get the best flavor and quality in the rum is to control fermentation immediately. And if you cut that sugar cane, you know, it's open. It's exposed to all the open air yeast and what have you, and fermentation will even happen inside the stock. So, I mean, they do give you some leeway, but for us, you know, you're supposed to have the cane is supposed to be crushed within 24 hours, but I told you mm-hmm. we're doing it in less than an hour.
Mm-hmm. And what does that allow, what does that result in, Ben? Working that quickly, say if you were to wait 24 hours versus an hour,
it's just the freshness. I mean, all the flavor and all the aroma and all the character in the rum really comes in fermentation, and so fermentation is key.
Mm-hmm.
And better to have it under, you know, in your control. And you know, now fast forward into today's technological universe. I mean, we have a laboratory. We're testing for pH. We're testing for Brix level. We're testing for humidity and whatnot. And so, with being able to have this at your fingertips, you know, and be able to work with the product, you know, it gives you consistency, of course, and you're always looking for the best optimum product that we can mm-hmm. that we can absolutely put out.
Gotcha.
Jeff, what are your thoughts on this, on the Agricole?
Well, for me, since I approach most rums as like, what can you do with them in a glass with other ingredients, Agricole is so distinct and has such a unique character that it doesn't really like to play well with others. I mean, most of the great tiki drinks that use Agricole use only Agricole. Mm-hmm. For example, the Last Rites cocktail, which is just like 3 ounces of Agricole Vu. Don't mix with anything else. And, of course, the tea punch and other things. However, it can be done. And when it is done right, it's pretty amazing. And the most glaring example, of course, is the Mai Tai, where you're taking an ounce of Agricole Vu, we use Clément VSOP here, mm-hmm. and an ounce of a dark Jamaican molasses-based versus sugarcane-based. For some reason, the alchemy of mixing those two things together gives you a base spirit that no one bottle could give you, just really just a rich, layered, almost kind of mysterious taste. And to that, we have to credit Trader Vic, who came up with that combination. Mm-hmm. Don the Beachcomber, who, as far as I know, invented the practice of mixing more than one rum in the same drink. He was the sort of the genius who came up with that. I'm not so sure that he ever mixed Agricole and molasses-based rums. He had some great cocktails that use Agricole.
But just exclusively.
Exclusively. Yeah, the Martinique cocktail, for example, is a beautiful drink, but that's just Agricole.
What is that?
That is basically an Agricole daiquiri, only with the usual things he does, a little drab of, just a little dash or drops of other flavoring agents, a little falernum, for example, a little anise, just drops of this, that, and the other thing in there, and flash blended the way he always did. Even though it's served up in a coupe, you still put a little bit of crushed ice with the ingredients in a blender and flash blend it for a few seconds, and then strain out the ice, and it just gives you a beautifully diluted and a beautifully chilled drink. And it's, again, all Agricole. It's like, I think Don's view about Martinique rum, if I could try to read his mind many decades after he passed, is that he didn't like to mess with it. It's just like, leave it alone. It doesn't need
just
to
let
be
it,
mixed
let
with
it
any.
Shine through. And,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How would we describe? There's always such a distinct taste that I think that you get from Agricole in general, and there's sort of, I always kind of call it an earthy note because I come from a wine background. Is that sort of fair?
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's more, especially the white, the mm-hmm. unaged is
the unaged, yeah.
really pronounced. That grassiness. Mm-hmm. It's very herbal. Mm-hmm. And the more time it spends in the wood, by the time you get to, you know, the JM Gold by the time you get to the JM VS or VSOP, that really earthy, grassy herbalness starts to disappear when the wood does its thing. And it's tempered, you know, it's still there. It's an undercurrent. You can still get it in this that we're drinking now. Mm-hmm. But the top note of this one is more of a nutty kind of taste.
Yeah.
Whereas most molasses rum gives you more sort of a vanilla mm-hmm. Top note. But this, mm-hmm. but Agricole, for some reason, has more nutty one. I always assumed it was French oak, which does different things than American oak. But Ben, you were saying that this is aged in American oak.
Yes, right? It's American oak.
So there goes that theory.
Yeah, and you get the, I think with American oak too, you can, I get a little bit of a fruity note, like a kind of a cherry mm-hmm. sort of note, which is pretty common with American oak. And the aging, to me, adds a really nice, there's a nice mouthfeel to it, like what it does to the mid palate. And I think, Jeff, to your point too, talking about how, we're going to take a break in about 30 seconds, guys, but to your point about comparing it to wine, I think is really fair, because some of these terms that I'm using, mid palate, mouthfeel, and these things, that's the same thing in wine.
Yeah,
right?
That's right. Yeah.
Let's do this, you guys. Let's go ahead and take that break now, since I've pontificated right there. And and we're going to come back, and after we take a break, we're going to taste an example of a St. Lucia, molasses-based rum.
So you've been drinking.
Yeah, I've only had like 3 sips of the Agricole, and my geography's gone out the window.
It's 100 proof. All is forgiven.
I'm screwed up, Jeff, because we call things like Burgundy and Calliope here in New Orleans, so I'm totally screwed.
Our French is awesome.
Yes, it is. Friends, are going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back.
If you ever go down Trinidad, they make you feel so very glad.
Calypso sing and make up rhyme. Guarantee you one real good fine time. Drinking rum and Coca-Cola. Go down Point Cumana. Both mother and daughter. Working for the Yankee dollar.
Welcome back to the program. Brian Diaz here with you. Yep, we're talking about rum at Latitude 29. It seems to be a pretty logical place to talk about rum. And we're here with Jeff Beach Bumberry, the co-proprietor, along with his lovely wife, Anine, who I saw backing out of the parking lot, Jeff, when I was walking in. She was going to do errands.
Yes, as is her wont.
As is her wont, right. And also Ben Jones from Spiribomb, who has a portfolio, and they own several distilleries and several labels. And in the previous segment, as you heard, we sampled a really lovely Agricole and aged Agricole. And now, you guys, what we're going to do, just to contrast this, is we're going to taste a molasses-based rum from St. Lucia, or Santa Lucia, however you want to say it, whatever language you're trying to speak, of which I can do neither any language of any sort. But let's talk about this one, you guys. Tell us a little bit about this one, Ben.
So this is a Chairman's Reserve, and we are day sipping on the Forgotten Cask from Chairman's Reserve, which on itself has a beautiful story, but I'll start with the Chairman's Reserve story. It really came out as sort of the premier export brand from St. Lucia about actually 20 years ago. St. Lucia has always had a long heralded history in the rum world, but, you know, took a back seat, I think, to the more well-known rum producing regions, islands in what I would say that would have previously flown the English flag. So, you know, people know the Jamaican rums and the Barbadian rums very well. But St. Lucia is right there, and deservedly so. And I think Chairman's Reserve came to be to put that flag back on the island of St. Lucia in that style at the St. Lucia Distillers, which is a very nice original name for the only distillery left in St. Lucia. But, you know, it is quite literally a craft distillery because we have four different stills operating at the same time. We have a traditional coffee column still, two John Doerr stills, which come from Scotland, and a Vendome still from Kentucky, all producing wonderful different types of rums of different flavors and bodies and mediums and whatnot. And the Chairman's Reserve really came to be as a blend of that coffee column still rum and the pot still rum. And you'll see on all the bottles, not just the Chairman's Reserve, but from the rest of the St. Lucia Distillers portfolio, there are really no age statements. It's really about the art of the blending of these rums and blending these different flavor profiles from the different stills and different oak barrels and whatnot. And that's really what Chairman's Reserve as a brand successfully does. So the original Chairman's Reserve, which was launched in 1999, is basically a blend of 3-year column still rum and 5- and 6-year-old pot still rum, and blended together, and then allowed to rest an additional 6 months, just to make sure that.
Let me ask you this question: when we're talking about coming from a pot still versus a column still, what would be some key flavor profiles or descriptors from the column still versus the pot still?
Well, certainly the pot still gives you a heavier rum.
Okay.
And a lot more body and just bigger aromas and flavors, which come from the esters. And column still rum is always traditionally known to be, you know, a lighter style rum, fresher. And really in a rum like this, that's really not so different than how Jeff was explaining how tiki drinks came to be, but, like, you know, blending different styles of rums like that from the own distillery. And, you know, there are different proportions, and they might be aging at different lengths, you know. So the pot still rums are aging a little longer to maybe take some of that edge off, that punchy edge off the pot still. You know, that's really up to the hand of the maker. Mm-hmm. And using, you know, age, you know, the younger components of this blend are from the column still, and the older components are from the pot still.
Okay.
And so that's where the blender really gets to play in his workshop and put these these together, and Chairman's Reserve in that way really became this sort of showcase of St. Lucia rum talent, expertise, you know, really being the flag bearer of the St. Lucia rum heritage as a origin for producing rum.
When you're making this rum, then because obviously I think what we're talking about here is creating a flavor profile that's consistent.
Yes.
Throughout the line, how much then on a year to year basis, or maybe I should say it this way, a blend to blend basis, is there variation to continue to consistently achieve a style?
No, that's up to the blender.
Okay.
Specifically, because I mean, certainly every batch and every vintage, every year, I mean, it's going to always be something different, and they are really blending, I would say, manually. I think our blender has honestly the best job in the entire company, because when I go and see him in his office, he'll have small little sample bottles that he's pulled out of all the different barrels that we have in our inventory, and he might have anywhere between 25 to 30 little wine tasting glasses open, and he's really tasting all the different rums, and it's his job to, you know, keep that consistency and guard that flavor profile. And certainly there are notes and certain recipes, but like I said, there's variations, and I call it a manual process, and he does have the best job, because he's doing what we're doing right now, but you know, over the course every day.
Yeah, and is responsible for something, whereas we're not having to be responsible for anything,
like,
right?
How do you make day drinking your job?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Now, the Forgotten Cask that we're enjoying is a unique story. I told you the Chairman's Reserve became, you know, quite well known to be the sort of premier rum from St. Lucia, and it sold well in St. Lucia, but you know, the big local brand St. Lucia is Bounty, so Chairman's Reserve was really, you know, it really took off like a rocket ship, particularly in the UK and in England, where they really love their English style rums, and it fits very well next to the, you know, the Appletons of the world or the Mount Gay's mm-hmm. world, which are the, you know, the most well known brands from Jamaica and Barbados. Forgotten Cask is an interesting story. In 2007, unfortunately, the distillery suffered a horrific fire. And I told you that, you know, Chairman's Reserve, it spends, you know, the last final 6 months after they do the blend to make sure everything, you know, marries up together and is nice. During this fire, they lost all of their administrative buildings. Actually, the distillery was spared. You know, some of the cellars were damaged, but they put a lot of, they were basically forced to work out of portable trailers and whatnot, and they put all these barrels and whatnot, and they were stored in containers and put away. And it took about 3 years to, you know, do their whole rebuilding process and get reorganized. And at the end of that 3 or 4 year process, honestly, was they found about 40 something plus casks of this Chairman's Reserve that was really intended to be only resting for 6 months, but additionally aged in a very, very hot environment for another 3 or 4 okay. years. And so they released it in the UK as the Forgotten Cask, just limited edition, as like a one-off, but it was so wildly popular that we had this big demand for it, and you know, it took us a couple of years to react, but we came out with the Forgotten Cask. And so the rum we're enjoying now is not from the original limited edition release, and you can, for those of you who are looking at eBay, you can see limited edition on the bottom, that's the original one, which there's a few bottles out there floating around, but this is where we've intentionally sort of copied, try to mimic what had happened. So we take that Chairman's Reserve after it's been blended, and rather than letting it sit for 6 months, it sits for another 4 years. And so it's effectively okay. double the age of the Chairman's Reserve original.
Got it. Great. We got about 2 minutes left, a little less than that, you guys. Jeff, give us maybe your thoughts on this in about a minute, and then I want to make sure we get to contact information.
Yeah, well, this, again, here's the night and day difference. I mean, this is like a much more heavy-bodied, denser.
Creamy. Yep.
Creamier and sweeter rum. You know, and I'm not really getting any of that nuttiness that you get from the Agricole. Mm-hmm. It is more of like the, sort of that vanilla vibe, but very, very. Mm-hmm. I think it's a great blend, and you can use it instead of like a dark Jamaican another English style. I mean, it is very much in the English style as opposed to the French. That's another 10-minute conversation:
right.
English, French, and
you guys are sticking
around
for the podcast stuff, so we can get it
right. But. As opposed to the French style with the jam, you've got this English style, really heavy-bodied punch rum, basically. And it's going to stand up to anything you do to it in a cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
Not that you would... I mean, I drink it just with a big cube, a king cube.
Yeah, and it's nice at room temperature, neat, yeah. as we're enjoying
and
it.
And it's on our sipping list here at Latitude.
Oh,
you know?
Okay,
we don't really
cool.
use it in any cocktails. You could, but... You know, it's nice.
Enjoy
nice
it
on
as
ice.
It is. Great. Well, let's do this. Ben, tell people very quickly. We've got about 45 seconds left. Where can people connect with the brand, Spiritbomb?
Well, so Spiritbomb itself has its own Facebook page as well as Instagram, and then we have a website, www. www.spiritbomb.com. There's the rum talking there. I'm easy to find on Instagram. I'm Mr. Rum, R-H-U-M, M-I-S-T-E-R-R-H-U-M, as well. I'm on Facebook, of course, and anyone can find me. You go to the website or we're a small family, so just knock on the door.
Easily found. Yeah. Great. And you guys are going to stick around for another shot with Noah Drinks. Jeff, tell people where we can find you at Latitude 29.
Yeah, Instagram is Latitude 29 Noah. And you can. I got a website, beachbunberry.com, which can direct you to the Latitude 29 restaurant website as well. But that's basically easy to find. Yeah.
Great. Oh. And all your publications and everything else. Well, you guys, we're gonna close out the show here on the radio side, and you guys are going to stick around for the podcast side. So, friends, remember, be kind to one another, use your turn signal, and until next time, cheers, y'all. Shot with Noah Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you as always. Hope you're enjoying this fascinating conversation about rum with Ben and Jeff. We're going to bounce right back over to Latitude 29 and carry on that conversation a bit further. And then I'll be back with my parting shot honoring the great Leah Chase. Here we go. Yep, another shot with Noah Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. We are at Latitude 29. Jeff, what's the address here? Do we say that when we close out the radio portion?
320 Decatur, or you just find the Bienville House Hotel and enter through there.
Okay, perfect. Right by the Mississippi River. Friends, be sure if you're not from the area, or if you are from the area, if you're not from here, come pay him a visit when you come to see us in New Orleans. And if you are from here and you haven't been to Latitude 29, shame on you.
One of the best rum bars in America, and definitely get a nice tropical drink.
Without a doubt, with a whole dose of storytelling and knowledge behind it. And so let me ask you guys this question. So we've talked quite a bit, obviously, about rum and sort of had a Caribbean focus. Can we tell people, in a nutshell, what is arrak and what is cachaça? Because I think those are kind of cousins to rum, are they not?
Yeah, well, cachaça is a cane spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course. I mean, Ben, do you want to take that one?
I mean, commonly when I'm talking to, honestly, anyone, you know, but of course, there's people that come from all different backgrounds, but I like to lead with the fact that, you know, sparkling wine, as an example, you know, you were using, Jeff, analogies of wine and whiskey before, and on that one, I like to use sparkling wine as a category because, you know, for us, rum agricole being AOC and tightly controlled and a specific flavor profile, you know, that are heavily guarded traditions, it's easy to draw that analogy of champagne to rum agricole, mm-hmm. you know, specific zone of origin and methodology of practice and production. And then you've got, you know, Spanish sparkling wines known as Cava and Prosecco from Italy, as well as French Accord and other sparkling wines. And I guess that would be, for me, more of an analogous to cachaça, or as well as other cane spirits. It's really just, you know, again, going back into the traditional practices of those said spirits, if you want to talk about cachaça, I mean, Brazil is the largest sugar producer in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in fact, a lot of their energy resources are coming from sugar. So that they know a thing or two about producing sugar for consumption, as well as for energy, for power, and for spirit, for drinking. And with that, that gives them an opportunity to make a huge, long variety of spectrum of different types of spirits. Arak, yes, cane, and as well as they're splicing maybe some rice into it. Some of the industrial spirits from Brazil will actually splice some corn into it, you know, whatnot. Mm-hmm. All, of course, under that cane spirit umbrella. And there are vicious debates on whether is it rum or is it not rum? Is it a cousin to rum? And, you know, even the cachaça producers, you know, they argue amongst themselves, you know, do we want to be labeled as a rum or do we want to be independent?
Yeah, some people call it Brazilian rum because they're not allowed to call it cachaça if it doesn't
right.
Yeah, cachaça is an interesting spirit because it doesn't really get its due. For most of my adult life, the stuff that I could get in U.S. liquor stores was basically moonshine. You know, just like unaged white cachaça, and it was just really kind of not palatable at all. And only fairly recently have some of the more aged, refined Brazilian brands made their way up here. And it's kind of a real eye-opener because what do they use, like 100 different kinds of native Brazilian wood or just another one?
Native and otherwise.
Yeah. And it's almost like drinking something from an alien planet because we're so used to everything being aged in oak. And then you get something aged in like a Brazilian rainforest, tiger wood or something like that.
Yeah.
And it tastes like an alien spirit. It really does. And it's kind of a fascinating, I mean, I haven't even cracked the surface of it yet. I've just tasted a couple of little expressions here and there at cocktail festivals. But I mean, it is a cane spirit. It is, you know, from that. Now, Arak, I'm going to try and channel Dave Wondert here. He knows much more about this than I do. Everything I'm going about to tell you is probably misremembered from his books. That was a very loose blanket term to define just about any kind of fermented or distilled spirit from Southeast Asia in the 17th century. You could distill arak from Javanese red rice. You could distill it from palm sap. All these various things. I don't know if you can really get away with calling it a rum. Although I think the Housall Penn's Batavia arak might be cane. Might be sugar-based. I mean, they also distilled from sugar sometimes. But it's a much more catch-as-catch-can kind of thing than cachaça is, I think.
Got it. Yeah. Great. Thank you for answering that question, you guys. I think we're seeing, in the United States and in other places, we're seeing more of this stuff come into the market. And there's that interesting, like with cachaça, there's that interesting debate where, as you mentioned, I think, Ben, where do they want to call themselves rum or do they not want to call themselves rum? And some people will turn blue in the face arguing with you that it's not rum. And I get it because there's a sense of terroir and a sense of place, which is, I think, something that we're getting at here. Let me ask you guys this question. So when we're talking about all the different countries and different, then therefore terroir and different styles of rum, how tightly clustered do we see these styles? Meaning, if I can taste a particular rum from Jamaica and go, man, that's Jamaican, or Barbadian or from Martinique or anything like that, are we starting? Is it really tightly clustered in a style and an approach that remains consistent across geographies? Or are we starting to see spread? I know it's kind of a really loaded question, but it's like wine. You know, it gets harder and harder to be able to blind taste something and know where it comes from.
Well, Brian, I think that's a great question, actually, especially in 2019. I mean, when I was first getting introduced to rum, it was very much defined by place. I learned to distinguish Jamaican from Barbados, from Puerto Rican, from Martinique, and it all had to do with origin, and the styles were all rooted in where they were distilled and aged and blended. But now, Caribbean rum is not the only rum out there, and you have rums coming from Central America, South America, Mauritius, Africa, just about any India.
New Orleans.
New Orleans. American rum is coming back in a big way. That was not the case when I started drinking rum back when dinosaurs walked the earth in the 80s. And it's gotten to the point now where it's so much more. I mean, I think Ian Burrell was the one who said that every single continent except for Antarctica or the Arctic distills rum. I mean, anywhere sugar grows, you've got rum being made. So now the Caribbean hegemony might be giving way a little bit to a more global perspective of rum. I've been tasting a lot of rum from Mauritius, a lot of rum from various other continents. But to me, because they've had so many more centuries to get it right, the Caribbean rum is still for me the gold standard.
Okay.
And the variations that occurred over the centuries in the Caribbean from the French style, the English style, the Spanish style, that's still how I really recognize rum. And if you get rum from Central America, get rum from Venezuela, get rum from Guatemala, it can still pretty much fall into that camp of English or, you know, Spanish style.
Okay.
I mean, a little bit difference because they like to add sugar to it, which kind of throws you off a little bit. But
which you can do, right?
But Ben, what do you got?
No, I mean, what I would add to that simply is that I think you're spot on as far as stylistically. It comes from a place of origin, but it's not so easy to just simply look at a map and spin the globe. I really need to dive a little bit deeper in ancestral sort of cultural, you know, influences into how those origins started producing rum. And so even when you're talking about, you know, new style rums like American, you know, the newer craft distillers, or even like, you know, there's rums made in Japan and in the Philippines and in Asia.
Okinawa, yeah.
Yeah. You know, but how do they choose to produce, you know, with a pot still, column still, blended, you know, their aging, the aging statements, you know, the methods of aging, or, you know, if they adopt a Solera method, for example, mm-hmm. they still follow some sort of, you know, sort of blueprint that, that was, you know, fathered in the Caribbean. And that really doesn't come from the Caribbean. In my opinion, it's really what came from the colonization, the ancestors that came from, let's say, Europe into the region. And so it's, you know, it's quite easy to understand that, you know, in Martinique and in the French Caribbean islands, where we are making basically a sugarcane eau de vie, you know, directly from a sugarcane wine, and we've more or less, you know, adopted distilling practices, borrowed and mimicked from the brandy producers in Armagnac and Cognac. And then, of course, we took their age statements and so on and so forth. And then, you know, in the Spanish, let's say, countries' origins, you know, they sort of took their influence from the Cuban methods of distilling the rum, but the aging, and everyone was trying to improve what they were offering to the market. And, you know, that Solera method was certainly borrowed from sherry and Spanish brandies. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in the English style rums, as we're talking about, you know, they've sort of adopted a style of blending pot and column still rums, and then you can see different sort of sub-segments under there as far as, you know, the overproof, the navy grogs, and then spiced rum certainly comes from there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the going back, I mean, it's simple when we can talk about and use analogies. When I'm talking to a wine sommelier crowd, I like to take a big category of wine like Chardonnay. And if you get California Chardonnay, that's like, you know, oak, bomb, buttery, fruity, what have you. And then you have Chardonnay from Burgundy in France, like a Chablis, or maybe even a Chardonnay from Australia. Yes, they're all from the same grape. They're in that same category, but worldly different wines. And by the way, your wine list has to have them all because you have lots of different people that come in and order fish to meat to whatever, chicken, poultry, whatever. And mm-hmm. they want to choose the wine that's going to go with their food to create the best experience. And that's the same thing with rum. Or in your cocktail, same thing with your cocktail. If I'm talking to more of a bartender or a spirit enthusiast, you know, I draw the comparison to the overall whiskey category. And so, you know, American whiskeys, you know, particularly bourbon whiskeys, have a very specific flavor profile, and it's very easy, again, to spin the globe and figure out where was bourbon born, where does it come from? And then, you know, it's a little bit easier. Where does Canadian whiskey come from? And, you know, there's a specific flavor profile that is expected with Canadian whiskey, with having a higher rye content. Irish whiskey is being three times distilled. Where does Irish whiskey come from? That's a little bit easier.
Mm-hmm.
When you get into Scotland, blended scotch versus single malt, and then you can break down single malts between Islay, Speyside. We were tripling over this before. Islay, Speyside, Highland, Lowland.
right.
But yeah, they all have their own flavor profiles, and people who have really, you know, gone further into it, they can really pick those out of a glass. With rum, it's a little bit more complicated because here, right in front of us, we've got a bottle of Martinique Rum Agricole and a bottle of St. Lucian Rum, the Chairman's Reserve. These islands are side by side, and you couldn't find two worldly different individual spirits together. So you can't just spin the globe. You need to kind of go a little bit deeper on the historical sort of, you know, influences and ancestral influences into how those rums came to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just can't like look at the Caribbean and be like, oh, you know, I'm going to have this rum. It takes a little bit further. And that's what I hope to achieve today, this afternoon, with our bartending crowd.
That's great. Really, really well said. I thank you for saying this, because I think, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, Ben, but what I'm gathering is this idea that maybe we need to think about it this way. People had the know-how, right? They had the equipment and they had the know-how to distill. So they brought the equipment and they brought the know-how. It's the raw material that they encountered that they decided to use. And then from there, there becomes a sort of dance, right? I'm suspecting of deciding which technology came from the old world or wherever it came from in certain instances, and then how does it work best? And then it starts to grow in lockstep with the raw material and the terroir and so on. Is that a fair way to put it?
You put words in my mouth.
Perfect. I did. Okay, yes. Great. And high five again. Well, let me ask you this question, because you mentioned the Cuban distillation method and, mm-hmm. and its effect. What do you mean by that?
Oh, I mean early on, some fantastic rums were made in Cuba, and they were, purposely made and distilled to be of a lighter style, more for mixing drinks, not for like so much sipping like we have we're enjoying with the Chairman's Forgotten Cask. And then what I always thought was brilliant, and honestly, you might better, or maybe you got to call our friend Steve, but they adopted and enforced the fact that all of their white rums are still aged. And I love what, the Cuban white rums and how they perform it, a daiquiri, the country's cocktail, having like really nice, soft, frothy white rum, shaken with lime and sugar and having that age to it. I think it does wonders. And certainly, that's going on for sure in Cuba. And the people that say I make rum in the Cuban style, I hope that that's what they're following, because that's what they're saying they're doing. And I mean, that's what it really means to say. It's definitely a lighter style in the flavor spectrum, as well as, taking that extra step of aging and then filtering after or what have you. But really, I'm a big fan of Cuba.
Yeah, I mean, Ben's sort of hit it when about the aging and then filtering to make it a white rum again. Some Cuban whites are more straw colored because they don't really filter out all the color, but doing that gives you a rum that tastes like rum, as opposed to a rum that tastes like an unaged neutral spirit. Mm-hmm. You know, like you definitely, even though it's a white rum, it tastes very, very emphatically like a cane spirit. And that's it's an awesome thing with a little lime and sugar. Absolutely,
mm-hmm. It's the best way to show the expression, right?
To me, it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
well, it's the ultimate litmus test in all of rum, really.
It reminds me of tequila, right? Because I think a lot of people, I always ask to taste the blanco or the white, because to me that shows me what the spirit is, and I taste the agave, and I taste the method, and I taste the hands behind it, as opposed to the masking from wood and things. I don't want to say masking, but what wood does to it.
Yeah, and no one would ever accuse any tequila of tasting like a neutral spirit. It definitely is going to taste like something very pronounced.
Right.
But there are rums that... they not only do they strip out the color, they kind of strip out all the flavor, good Cuban rum does not do that.
Let me ask you guys one last question on a term, and then so let me just ask you this question. I hear this more and more, because people will describe rums as like Smith and Cross or something as funky, having funk, and I think we know maybe that term is dunder, correct? Often in, what does that mean?
Well, I'm telling you that funk is not just perspective to Jamaica.
Sure.
But as I said earlier, I mean, flavor, aromas, that character comes in fermentation. And yes, as you know, as you made the reference to dunder, adding dunder back or stillage or vinasa, as we would do in Martinique, that's just bringing back, reintroducing bacteria and whatnot into your fermentation and creating, other pronounced, profound, very unique flavors, very difficult to work with. The people that do it well are really expert and brilliant in their craft. I would urge, the new distillers coming on board, like, don't try this at home quite yet, because it's quite complicated. But the ones that do it, and the ones that have decades and generations of practice and know-how, like our friends in Jamaica, do it well. And you know what? I'm also a big believer of, like, that's their thing. They do it well. That's what you're looking for, respect that tradition and go with that style of rum.
Yeah. Okay.
Just the same way that we make rum agricole and our sugarcane juice rum and our flavor profile, and I believe we do it better than anyone else in the world. And that's something that we are very proud to wave that flag and so on and so forth.
Great, Jeff. Last question. And Ben touched on this pretty well, but what any sagely advice on people that are starting to step into the larger rum world? About maybe how to go about it, what to look for, just how to enjoy and appreciate and grow.
First thing is to don't touch your 401k. because there's such a vast specter of choice with rum in so many different categories that before you find the one you like or the one you like more than others, it could run you up quite a bit of money.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that the best way to go about it is to go to a bar, go to a rum bar. There's bound to be one in your town now, and ask for a flight of different kinds mm-hmm. of rum. Ask for a flight. Hey, can you give me a flight like an Agricole, English style, a Spanish style? And you can go from there. And you say, okay, well, I definitely like the French style best. I like it more than these other kinds. And that's when you start doing a flight of like French rums.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give me three different Agricoles, three different brands, and take it from there? Because there's a lot of bottles out there and a lot of brands and a lot of regions, and you can go down some blind alleys and spend a lot of money before you find something you like.
Got it.
So I think going to a bar and trusting your bartender and getting a flight together, like right here in New Orleans, if you're local, go to the Black Duck Bar, Dickie Brennan's place on the top floor of the Palace Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
They've got like, what, 200 rums? I mean, mm-hmm. if you can't find a rum you like there, then maybe it's
not
the category
for you. Right.
Then go to Bourbon House.
Then go to Bourbon House, right, and try the same exercise with whiskey. Yeah, that's a great point. So we're saying sort of a compare and contrast, right, is a good way to do it.
But you don't spend $30, $40, $50 on a bottle that you haven't tried yet. It's much more economical to spend $6, $8, $10 on a shot, you know, of something and then see if you like it. You know?
But did you hear what Jeff just said? $30, $40, $50 for a bottle? That's a pretty damn good rum at 30, 40, 50. I mean, that's what rum that's what rum really does, is over delivers in value, because, you know, we tried that Chairman's Reserve Forgotten Cask, you know, effectively, you know, 10 years old, right? $50 a bottle in the shelf, which, you know, for rum, I guess, could be considered pretty pricey. Mm-hmm. You could probably have it here for, what, 12? I don't know your pricing, yeah. $12, $15 maybe. But I would say as a spirit, side by side, it's in comparison to a 200, 300 year old scotch, or, you know, $400 cognac, or $200 scotch, what have you. My point is that we have a great, I guess, advantage as well as a disadvantage of aging in the Caribbean. We're able to achieve a lot more, a lot faster, because we don't have winter, because we have this very hot, humid tropical climate that gives us, you know, a tremendous oak extraction. And so, you know, 4 years old Clément VSOP, you know, has the equivalent age expression of a, you know, a 10 to 12 year old bourbon. Or even a 18 to 20 year old scotch, and you know, if you could be enjoying a glass for $10 or $12 of the Clément VSOP at 4 years old, or you can go, and if we were at the same bar, that I'm a little bit biased, but I would argue that, you know, a whiskey or another spirit or a brandy of equivalent quality would cost you double or triple that. And so I would encourage, you know, not just traditional rum drinkers, but people that enjoy spirits, fine spirits, to jump into the rum category. What better place to do it? Is that a place like Latitude, where you have some different selections to, mm-hmm. to play with? And the bartenders are certainly very, very knowledgeable about the spirits, and so they can steer you in the right direction, whether you're a scotch drinker, are you a bourbon drinker, are you a tequila agave drinker, what have you. I mean, they can help you sort of get you started on your pathway to...
Next
and that's,
step.
That's been the last thing you said. If you're a whiskey drinker, tequila drinker, gin drinker, there is a rum for you, because mm-hmm. it is such a vast category with so many vast flavors that if that's your gateway, you can find something that works for you. You know, for example, like when we have whiskey drinkers coming, especially scotch drinkers, and they say, well, yeah, okay, what kind of rum would I like? JM VSOP is a very peaty, dry, scotch-like rum, and it's like, boom, done. Mm-hmm. And there's an equivalent if you like other kinds of spirits. There's always going to be something out there that's going to be distilled, blended, aged in such a way that you're going to find be simpatico with it.
Yep, and use that as your gateway into a larger world, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, one more time, Ben, tell people where they can connect with you and Spirit Bomb.
Simply, our website is www.spiribam.com. That's SPIRIBAM. Find us on Facebook. We have an Instagram. Personally, I'm Mr. Rum, MisterRhum on Instagram, and very easy to find on Facebook as well. And you can connect with me through our company or website, because, you know, we're a small family, so it's everything. You knock on the door, I can hear you.
Great. Awesome. And Jeff, what about, where can we find you at Latitude, and where can we find you in the publication world as well?
Sure. Instagram is Latitude29NOLA, and I've got a website, beachbumberry.com. It'll tell you about all the books and the iPhone app for recipes and all that other stuff that I put out. And then just Google Latitude 29 and you'll get the restaurant website as well.
Awesome. You guys, Ben, Jeff, thank you so much for taking some time.
Thank
you, Brian.
I really
appreciate it. Friends, we're going to take a brief musical interlude and I will be back with my parting shot. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening into the show this week. As always, I really appreciate it. Hope you enjoyed that conversation with Jeff Beachbum Barry and Ben Malone Jones talking about rum. I found it a really fascinating conversation. It was a great tasting, by the way, and a discussion that Ben put on at Latitude 29 after the interview. Really cool stuff. Quick programming note, friends, that I mentioned at the top of the show. We're doing things a little bit differently. About a year ago here on the NOLA Drink Show, we changed our format where we went an hour on the radio and then had our exclusive and have our exclusive podcast-only content. That's what you're hearing right now, of course. Another shot with NOLA Drinks, and we really like it that way. It allows us to get a little further into the weeds and all that good stuff as we often do. And if you regularly listen, you know that. But what we're doing, so what would happen is the show airs typically, or doesn't typically, it airs on Mondays, 7 o'clock on 990 a.m. and repeats most Fridays in the same time slot, 7 to 8 p.m. And then we would put the podcast out on Tuesday or Wednesday after that initial radio airing on Monday with all that extra content that I talked about. So what are we doing different? Not really a big deal, but I think it's a cool thing. We're actually going to get the podcast out to you sooner, friends, with all of that content. The idea being that the podcast will come out typically on Mondays before, right about the same time that it airs on radio. But again, the podcast, as you're listening to here, is the only place that you can hear Another Shot with NOLA Drinks, where we'll have our extended conversation as we do and other special features coming up as we develop those. So wanted to mention that to you as well. Friends, also something I mentioned at the top of the show here for our parting shot. We lost a great one, friends, the great Leah Chase. Restaurateur and so much more. She passed away on Saturday over the weekend at the age of 96. Of course, there are so many more people much more eminently qualified to speak about her life and legacy than me. But I did want to share some thoughts, and I just don't think it's possible to overstate the importance and influence that Leah Chase had not only on New Orleans, but well beyond, really around the world. Of course, famous restaurateur, operator of Dookie Chase. In that regard, she certainly helped put Creole cuisine on the map, made it a cultural force, as New Orleans Mayor LaToya Cantrell recently said. I think that's true. Leah Chase was also a civil rights activist and a hero. Her restaurant, Dookie Chase, was a haven, a safe space for activists. She fed the leaders of many of the leaders of the civil rights movement in that restaurant, and as well as African-American entertainers that couldn't eat in other spots in New Orleans during Jim Crow years. New Orleans was a crossroads, if you will, for activists to kind of stage activities, protests, caravans, things that they would do in other states as well as around Louisiana. And yeah, so the police knew what was going on for the most part at Dookie Chase, at least within New Orleans, kind of left things alone. Certainly they did not come away unscathed. Someone threw a pipe bomb at the restaurant, lots of threatening notes and things like that. But for the most part, Dookie Chase was a place where activists, as I said, civil rights leaders, could get a meal before they went out in the field to pursue their activism in really a safe space, exchange ideas, get a good meal in their belly. Leah was also a patron of the arts. She supported Black artists long before you would see their work in galleries and museums. Her restaurant really itself was a museum in a lot of ways. And fortunately, a lot of the artwork, if not all the artwork, I'm not 100% sure, was actually saved from the restaurant when the restaurant was heavily flooded during Katrina. Actually, as a side note, she and her late husband, Edgar Dookie Chase II, they actually lived in a FEMA trailer for a year, and they remained committed to reopening the restaurant. Leah was a longtime trustee of the New Orleans Museum of Art. She also testified before Congress on behalf of the National Endowment of the Arts. Leah was also a staunch believer in New Orleans and so much more. One thing that she said in her words, quote, "I think we're going places, especially when you get everyone to come together. We have neighborhoods mixing and people doing better for themselves. We just need good leaders. We have a good city, and it's because of the people. I have people from all over the world who come to the restaurant, and they're amazed at what they see. They love New Orleans people. I don't know what they have where they're from that makes this so impressive, but I tell them this. It's just what we do here. This is how we live. No matter who we are, we know how to live." Another quote that I thought was great, Rudy Lombard, who is passed away, famous civil rights activist. He was one of the first people to stage a sit-in on the Canal Street
or one of the Canal Street lunch counters, big part of the civil rights movement here in New Orleans. And he said, quote, "If you're looking for a place that advanced integration and racial understanding, nothing stands out for me more than that restaurant and that lady. It was the only place where people knew blacks and whites could get together in a civil rights context without being hassled." So important. She remained, of course, always understated and always modest. She, in regard to that, in her role in the civil rights movement, she said, "I was just feeding people. They were fighting for something, and they didn't know what they would find when they went out there. They didn't know what would happen to them on the streets. But when they were here, they knew I'd feed them. That's what I could do for them." Xavier President Reynold Verrey has recently said, noting her passing, "Leah Chase was a vital force of equality in our great city. Not only did she feed countless locals and visitors, she nourished the souls of those fighting for civil rights. Through her culinary gift and elevation of service, she built bridges of humanity within our community that transcend boundaries of place or status." A couple more quotes from Leah herself. "People come in and say this is a black restaurant, but I tell them we all eat the same thing in New Orleans. We eat rice, we eat gumbo, we have a common language with food. It's our food. We all know our food here. We like our traditional dishes. And also, I've had groups here that I don't agree with, but I still invited them in as long as they followed my rules. You can still talk to people even if you disagree with them, and you can listen to them. When you spend time with each other, maybe you see something different." Again, so many more people out there, friends, than I am to comment more deeply on her life and her legacy. But one thing I do know is that we need more people like Leah Chase in New Orleans and really in the world now more than ever. Friends, that's our parting shot. Here's to you.